Hey, this is Devin Chalk from Haste Today, and you're listening to my chapter of As the Story Grows.
What would you say you do here?
Have a good time all the time.
Dominate.
Who got it better than us?
Nobody!
What in God's holy name are you blathering about?
Well, I'll tell you what I'm blathering about. I've got information, man.
I want you to be realistic.
What do you love about music?
Man, being realistic.
As the story grows.
I always wanted to be part of a small rebellion.
You got this, Travis. Make them wait for it.
You said you're in real estate?
Yeah, so I'm a realtor now.
That's it's funny to me how many band guys or former band guys end up in as realtors.
Yeah, I'm starting to discover more and more of them now that I've kind of made my announcement that I'm moving into full-time real estate. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, what led you to do that?
Yeah, it's kind of been a bit of a journey. You know, my wife and I bought our first house on the east side of Indianapolis in the spring of 2013. And I just enjoyed the whole process, everything from searching, trying to find the right house, to like going and looking at tons of houses, and even just pulling all the finances together, and just the whole process I thought was really cool. The whole home buying process was great. So when we were done, I just never stopped looking online at homes, and even bugged my realtor to take me to some places because I just had this fascination with the market. And so, it wasn't long before we ended up just a couple years later buying a new house. You know, I had gotten a new job and things were going really well there and we could afford a nicer house. So we bought a new house and rented out the old one, to friends. And then eventually 2 years later, we sold that house to those friends. And that kind of started our foray into real estate investment, as we were like, well, landlord light was pretty easy, you know, renting to our friends in a house we used to live in, you know, I called it landlord light, you know. Why don't we take a look at, you know, being actual landlords, and kind of learn about how to find and analyze deals and make sure that we, you know, set ourselves up for success to actually make some money, you know. And so that's what we did. And we bought a duplex just around the corner from where we were living and rented that out to a couple of tenants and have just really kind of been moving in that direction. And the long-term plan was always to be in real estate full-time. But we were planning to continue to build up the passive income of rental properties until, you know, I could quit the 9-to-5, but with ever increasing frustration with the typical 9-to-5 situation, decided to quit my job and go ahead and get into full-time real estate as a realtor and continue to be looking for other buy and hold opportunities and hopefully build up enough passive income that I can, you know, spend more time with family doing the things I want to do on my terms. So that's the long answer. I don't give short answers.
That's good. That's fine. Less talking I have to do. It's not about me anyways. So that's cool. You're still in Indianapolis. Is that where you grew up?
Kind of. I grew up in Canada. My family grew up in a little tiny town called Wingham, Ontario, in Huron County, a little town of about 3,000 people, kind of a rural town. A lot of my friends were farmers. We were like an hour and a half from the nearest shopping mall, you know, just way out there. We like went to the mall twice a year, and it was like a big deal, you know, back to school shopping and Christmas shopping. Other than that, we didn't get out much. So yeah, I grew up in Canada till I was 16, and then my dad got a job as a worship and arts director at a church in the suburbs of Indianapolis. And we went from living in a town of 3,000 where, you know, not a lot of income and not a lot of wealth in that town, to one of the richest zip codes in America. And it was quite the culture shock. Add to that, you know, the fact that we were moving to a multi-million people metropolitan area from the country. So it was kind of a bizarro world for us for a while there.
Yeah. So you said your dad was a worship pastor. So did you grow up around music your whole life?
So, yes. My dad and my mom were actually both atheists for most of their lives until they were like 35. So I grew up around lots of music, but not around Christianity, really. My parents both kind of thought it was silly. My dad used to equate Jesus to Batman. He'd say, well, there's lots of literature about Batman, and there's lots of literature about Jesus, and they're both silly, you know, was kind of his way of looking at Jesus and the supernatural.
Do you know what brought about his conversion, just going to church? Or?
Yeah, so it's a really interesting story, and I love sharing it. You know, when I was about 8 years old, and my brother Brennan, who was also in the band, singing guitar guy, he was three. My parents, for unknown and like just a really odd thing, for unknown reasons, they sent myself and my brother to a local church, to Sunday school. Maybe it was just to have like an hour and a half of time away from their two rambunctious kids. I don't know. That's probably the answer. And the very first time I was there, they were teaching about Paul on the road to Damascus, and I was just blown away. I'd never heard anything like it, being from an atheist household. You know, Paul being met on the road by Jesus. He was blinded, and you know, like just, I remember thinking, you know, I think this is true. And it's important, and something has to be done. But I'm like 8 years old, so I don't know what needs to be done after hearing a story like that, you know. But the Sunday school teacher afterward, you know, came up to me and said, hey, like, do you want to become a Christian like Paul? And it just clicked in my mind. I was like, that's it. That's what needs to be done, you know. I didn't want to be blind like Paul, but I knew that, like, becoming a Christian, following Jesus, was what needed to be done. And so that was my like moment from, you know, going from kid totally in the dark, not knowing God, to somebody who believed in Jesus and had light in his life. And my parents kind of had their own transformation. All of their friend group were all Christians, and they would get together with my parents and, you know, would talk about God and stuff. And it would become like kind of heated debates and stuff, but always in good fun, you know. But these people would get together and pray for my parents regularly for about 10 years. They would do this pretty faithfully. And my dad, being a pretty prolific musician, started writing music again, he grew up, you know, playing in bands as a kid and playing in bars when he was too young to be there. He finally started making music again. And as he started writing music, they started to have these spiritual overtones, which just totally was very peculiar for him. He couldn't understand what was happening. And about the same time, he started reading a book called No Compromise about Keith Green. So I'm dating myself here. We're talking early 90s at this point, late 80s. And my dad came to realize through reading that book that, you know, this Keith Green character, you know, who like was obviously inspired by God, doing great things for God, you know, had a genuine experience with God, and that God wanted to be involved in my dad's life. And so he kind of had this 180 turn, and my mom had a very similar experience at the same time, that they both kind of had this realization, like, wow, this whole God thing is real and we've been wrong for 35 years. So again, there's a long answer to what could have been a short question, but yeah, that's kind of how they kind of came around to their faith. And within 5 years, my dad quit his job as a teacher and moved to America to be a worship and arts director. And he's been in ministry ever since. So that's like 96 when we moved down here to the States. Yeah, so it's been kind of a wild ride, but I'm very thankful for it. I'm really glad to be here in Indy. It's a good place for me and my family.
So you said there was always music around. What are your first and earliest musical memories?
Yeah, so I mean, my dad, he was a fanatic. You know, he was constantly listening to records and then cassettes, and he was a pretty accomplished piano player. I still to this day don't know somebody who can play like my dad can play. He's just amazing. And so he always had a very high standard of excellence as far as like performance and learning your craft, putting in the work, and being able to reap the benefits of, you know, like being able to play something to make art that matters, something that's well played and skilled, you know. So at an early age, I started playing piano and got good enough at that to be somewhat proficient, you know, to play by ear and then also be able to read music. When I was about 12 years old at youth group, my youth pastor was a drummer, and I sat down at the kit after youth group once, or I got there early or something, and he said, "Hey, do you want me to show you how to play something?" I was like, "Yeah, of course." So he took like 2 or 3 minutes to show me a little something, and I picked it up really fast. And so he said, "If you want, you can come to youth group a half hour early every week, and I can teach you more stuff." So I did that for maybe 6 weeks, and my parents, you know, being very much encouragers of music, went ahead and bought me a really crummy old drum kit used off somebody for, I don't know, probably $100, you know. But I just started playing it for hours a day. You know, my parents were kind of nuts. They set it up in the living room of our house. And they knew that if they put it somewhere prominent in the house, I would walk by it and play it anytime I had a second. And that's how I played. I would play for 5 or 10 minutes, or I'd play for an hour, or I'd play for 20 minutes and just like made drums a part of like my everyday life, you know? And that kind of got things started.
That's cool. What got you into metal or heavy music?
Yeah. So, this topic is really near and dear to my heart. You know, I grew up, kind of in a fun era of Christian thrash metal. Certainly I started out listening to a lot of the stuff that my dad was listening to. My first cassette was, you know, Aerosmith, Permanent Vacation, you know. And so I was listening to some hard rock stuff, and as my parents became Christians and some of the media in our home started to change, I started listening to like Petra, you know, and, you know, the Christian equivalent to some of the hard rock stuff that my dad was listening to. But I started to branch out and listen to some stuff more on the fringes. We had a Christian bookstore in our town that carried a couple of titles here and there, kind of on the fringes. And so I started getting into some of the intense record stuff, but not the heavy stuff, you know. So like Angelica was one that I got into early on. And then my parents bought me a cassette, and I think you and Travis may have referenced this cassette in a somewhat recent episode. I can't remember which one it was. It might have been Jason Sherlock, but the Art for the Ears cassettes. Do you remember those? Am I right? Yeah. So it had like Tourniquet, Mortification, Deliverance, Angelica, Kenny Champlin, but Vengeance Rising, you know, and I remember hearing some of that thrash and death metal and more extreme forms of metal and thinking, like, getting really scared, you know. I'd never heard anything like that, Christian or otherwise. You know, particularly like Brutal Warfare, you know, there was just a lot of scary stuff on there. And so I put it away for a few months, you know, like, I'm never going to listen to that again. It's too scary. I don't understand it, you know. But over time, I kept on coming back to that cassette, and it started to grow on me, you know, hearing like that short excerpt of Psychosurgery, a short excerpt from Ark of Suffering, and going like, this is actually good guitar work. This is actually like really intelligent, like, you know, syncopated stuff. Maybe I could get into this, you know? And so that kind of got it started, but I had to like do mail order to get this stuff because nobody was carrying it. And I lived in a small farming town, you know? So I was like literally asking for their catalogs, you know, at this music store to see if they could order in Stop the Bleeding and Psychosurgery and then, you know, Pathogenic when it came out. And Tourniquet became like my favorite band very quickly, and then started getting into Mortification, Deliverance, Vengeance Rising, and all that stuff as well. And my parents being, you know, pretty amazing people were okay with me listening to this wild thrash and death metal stuff because they didn't come from a traditional Christian past. You know, they came from an atheistic rock and roll life, and they kind of understood what it was like to be into things that were kind of on the fringe and extreme. So they didn't have a problem with me and my brother Brennan, who was like 4 and 5 and 6, listening to, you know, speed metal like Deliverance and stuff like that, which is kind of funny looking back at somebody who's in kindergarten totally rocking a Stay of Execution cassette, you know. But that was kind of how we were living at the time.
That's awesome. I'm sure he appreciates all that now. You were the influential older brother.
yeah, exactly. You know, it was kind of a fun time, you know, for us as we were kind of discovering music, and my parents bought him a guitar. You know, we started jamming together and trying to mimic some of the sounds that we were hearing, you know, on like the Living Sacrifice records, particularly Inhabit. You know, that was when I started to really relate to that band. Though I liked Self-Titled and Non-Existent, I felt like Inhabit started to make a little bit more sense to me musically, and it really resonated. So we were trying to like mimic some of that stuff very poorly, you know. And of course, he was probably 9 or 10 years old, and I'm 14 or 15, you know, trying to figure out like how to play metal music. But yeah, those were really formative years for us listening to bands like that.
So did you two just jam together, or were there bands before Haste the Day that you were in, or both of you were in?
Kind of, you know, when I graduated from high school, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I didn't want to go to college. I didn't apply to any colleges. I just kind of was like, I don't know what to do. You know, I graduated with a 2.1 GPA, you know, wasn't super motivated in school. And so I got out of school and I started a youth group at the church. And so inevitably that meant like somebody needed to play the worship music. So that was me on a piano and Brennan on a guitar. And that kind of morphed over time into different things, like where we put together kind of a worshipy folk rock type band for a little while. And I don't know why we did it. None of us listened to Jars of Clay or bands like that at the time, or Cademan's Call or something. You know, it wasn't like our style of music. We were listening to metal, but we put together this poppy folk rock worshipy thing that led worship at our youth group, and then did a few like little dates here and there. And Mike, the bass player for Haste Today, actually sat in and played with the band for a bit. And then when I went off to Bible college, Dave Powell, who is in Emory now, actually replaced me while I was gone at college, and they changed the name of the band, and it kind of morphed into something else. So it was like nothing very serious, just lots of like silly garage band fun stuff. Nothing very heavy resulted from those things, but yeah, that's a little bit of the pre-Haste the Day history.
So then you guys formed Haste the Day. You wanted to do heavier music.
Yeah. So, Brennan and Mike were sophomores, maybe in high school, and I was older, and they kind of wanted to start a heavy band. You know, by that time we were all listening to Living Sacrifice, you know, kind of post Reborn era Living Sacrifice stuff, and Zayo. Those were probably our two most important influences at the time. And so they wanted to do something like those guys. And so they started writing music. And I was like home from school on a break, and we set up in the living room and we jammed for a little bit. And it was cool. It was really fun. But I felt like, you know, I'm kind of older than these guys. I don't want to, you know, impose, you know, and kind of, I want them to be able to have their own thing, you know, like, I wanted to make sure that I wasn't like coming in and like trying to dominate their thing that they were working on and having fun with. So I told them I would help them find a drummer, you know, that was more their age, you know, that could play with them all the time, because I had to go back to school. And they tried for a while to find somebody, and it just didn't work out. Nobody really had the chops, and nobody really caught the vision and understood like what they were trying to do. And so eventually they just said, Devin, why don't you just play, you know? So about that time I decided, well, why don't I take some time off school? I was getting really tired of being in college. And we'll kind of concentrate on the band for a bit. I'll work, and try and pay, you know, some school off and save up some money to go back to school, and we'll kind of go from there. And so it was just me and Brennan and Mike, and Mike, the bass player, did the lead vocals, and Brennan sang and played guitar, and I played the drums and did some singing. And, you know, for about 6 months, it was just the three of us writing and trying to, like, put together, like, a decent set list of songs and get tight. And about 6 months in, our friend Jason Barnes, who was playing in a couple other bands at the time, he was playing in Weapon X, with Dave Powell from Emory and Joel Kostler and Joel Lauber, and some of those guys would end up in Bowels of Judas, which toured with Haste the Day a while later. But we were all kind of swapping personnel, you know, at that time, everybody was trying to figure out what they were doing and where they wanted to be. And Jason ended up coming over to our band. And then a few months later, we recruited Jimmy to come and be our vocalist, which was, you know, little did we know, was kind of the, you know, what kind of catapulted us from being kind of these dorky Christian dudes trying to be in a metalcore band, you know, to, oh, Jimmy Ryan's in the band, you know, from Upheaval and, you know, like from the mid-90s, like hardcore legend, you know, kind of guy. And people started to kind of take notice. And we actually started to get kind of good, not real good, but good enough. And that was kind of, Jimmy Ryan joining the band was a big deal as far as our development was concerned.
Seen you guys at, what was it, Cornerstone 2003, Tooth and Nail Day, and just being blown away, and
yeah,
like buying the EP.
Yeah, awesome.
and being a fan like immediately. What led you guys signing with Solid State? Were there other labels involved, or was it like that was the label at the time, so that was where you wanted to go?
Yeah, it was a really exciting time. You know, we felt like we were building something meaningful. You know, we wanted to be a band that stayed true to our convictions and had one story to tell that was true, you know, from the beginning to the end. Even in the very beginning, we decided we're going to be in this band. We're going to be Christians. The Christian message, the gospel, is going to be central. We're not going to call ourselves a Christian band. We don't have to get into that whole, like, that whole discussion. But we knew that we always wanted to be about sharing the love of God with people. And, you know, that, you know, was, that was not super popular at the time outside of youth group type bands and youth group type labels. But anyway, we recorded our demo and we sent it out to everybody from Face Down to Universal Music, you know, like from majors to minors to Century Media and everybody. And we got like a pretty decent amount of interest and got, two or maybe three offers. We knew deep down we wanted to be with Solid State. That was something that we felt like would be a good home for us. They had worked with a lot of the bands, of course, that we loved, bands that were Christians, but were playing to the general market and were kind of crossing over. And we felt like that was where we wanted to be. We didn't want to preach to the choir. We wanted to go into the dive bars with nasty metal dudes and share God, make our ridiculous music, and try and tour the world, you know? But yeah, eventually Tooth and Nail, Solid State, did get in touch with us. And it's kind of funny. Like I hesitate to share this only because I don't think it, puts, you know, it doesn't matter. Doesn't matter. Nobody's going to be embarrassed by this. When we, you know, were first in talks with Tooth and Nail and Solid State, that whole thing, you know, they had requested some videos, you know, so we had some videos of some hometown shows, and the shows had gotten really big. You know, we had gone from playing for 50 people in the terrible, dumpy places, you know, to, you know, selling out 500 cap rooms. You know, we were just nobodies, you know, but for some reason we struck a nerve in Indianapolis and people wanted to come to Hey Soday shows. But so we sent them all this stuff, and so they're seeing like uncut, you know, like 40-minute sets of just pandemonium, kids just completely losing it. But they're also hearing Jimmy stop between songs and tell the meaning to a song and talk about how Jesus had changed his life and how he went from drug abuse to, you know, sobriety, and how Jesus was the reason for that, you know. And it's really interesting. When we first started negotiating and talking with Tooth and Nail, they told us, well, they didn't tell us, they asked us, like, hey, could you guys kind of tone down the preachiness, you know, which I at the time I remember thinking was such a silly thing, because, you know, they're supposed to be a Christian label, but in the end they're trying to market music to a greater audience, and they know if they have this preachy band, you know, on stage, it might be tough to fill clubs and sell records to the general market, you know. So I don't know if they fully got what we were trying to do, but we basically told them, like, listen, if you don't like the preachiness, you don't want Haste the Day, you know, because that's a core of what we've decided to be about, and we just can't compromise it. And so we weren't rude or abrasive, but we just kind of said, this is what Haste the Day is about. If you don't want that, you don't want us, you know. So, and we heard nothing about it after that, and we continued to talk. And it was kind of crazy. We had our entertainment lawyer, Joe Madonia, out of Chicago, who was far too big for, you know, working for us, but somehow we had him on board, and we negotiated with Solid State for 11 months. It was pretty painstaking and awful. But it got so bad that Brandon Ebel finally said, just get him in the studio in good faith that we'll get this thing done, because I'm tired of dealing with them, you know. Put them in the studio, and so we go to Barry Pointer, to Pointer's Palace, thinking, like, this is going to be the greatest. And we're still negotiating, and by this point, Hey Sade has started touring full-time. You know, we've all left school and work, and we're touring full-time, and now we're in the studio. We're dirt poor. We're broke as can be. The band has no money. The individuals in the band have no money. We're, like, literally scrounging, like, looking for change, you know, on the floor of our conversion van to buy bean burritos from Taco Bell, you know, like it was just, but we were having a blast, you know, like we didn't care. And then, so Tooth and Nail, like, I don't know, Brandon finally loses his cool and loses his patience with us. And he says, forget it. You know, like, they're either signing this deal the way it is, or we're pulling the funding for the studio and we're not paying for it and they can go home. And so our lawyer decided to call his bluff and said, that's fine, we'll pay for it and we'll put it out ourselves. And so that kind of got the ball rolling, and they finally relented and we came to terms. We finished recording the studio, they paid for it, and within a couple of months we actually signed the deal. And we were finally, you know, realizing our dream to be on Tooth and Nail Solid State.
Wow. Was it a good relationship after that?
Yeah, you know, it was. We knew that it was a business decision as much as, you know, like, there's always that clash between art and business, and the interests of art don't always line up with the interests of business. And we kind of understood that Tooth and Nail's role in those negotiations was to get as much out of us as they possibly could. And our role as artists, musicians, business owners, you know, we were an LLC, you know, was to get as much out of them as we could. And so it was okay, you know, going back and forth and arguing over points and number of records and all kinds of publishing issues and stuff. We just knew that once we were done with that, we could move on, and it didn't really bother us, you know, that, yeah, in the end, it was totally fine. And, you know, it was Roy Culver who actually signed us, and then shortly after that, he was no longer part of the picture. And we were kind of nervous. We actually got pushed to a guy named Zane, who was, at the time, he was a mailroom guy. He worked in the mailroom. And they started giving him bands, and we were one of his first bands, and I was just like, oh, we're sunk. We're totally screwed now. So it was kind of a tough time where we had Roy, who was, like, really pushing for us, trying to get us signed, and, like, working with Brandon to, like, hey, let's come to terms and get these guys signed. It's going to be a good thing. These guys are, this is a good band. To, like, our one advocate at the label being out of the picture and us being given to the mailroom guy. So it was a little bit scary after that.
It seemed like you guys had a huge growth in, I don't want to say status, but, like, When Everything Falls came out, like, it put you on the map a little more.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that was, really a landmark record for us. You know, we, with Burning Bridges, you know, like, we weren't happy with the mix. The mastering kind of saved the mix, but it still stunk. You know, we weren't very, very happy with it. And that was partly a result of our negotiating with Tooth and Nail while we were still in there, and ended up, you know, Barry ended up mixing it, which we didn't think was going to be good, and we were right. It wasn't good. And our record was the last Tooth and Nail or relevant, like, heavy record that Barry did, simply because I think when people heard Burning Bridges, they were like, oh, this isn't very good. It doesn't sound heavy. It's not raw. It's just kind of thin, you know, and I would have to agree, unfortunately. But, yeah, once we, you know, we toured on Burning Bridges really heavily, like, the first, like, our first full year of touring, you know, which half of which was before Burning Bridges came out, and like maybe half after that, we played almost 300 shows. We played like 295 shows that year. You know, we just busted our hump, you know, out there. And we proved to Tooth and Nail that, like, hey, these guys can sell some records. These guys are willing to work. We can afford to give them a bit more of a budget. And so, you know, we asked for a big enough advance to take 2 or 3 months off to write, and we wrote and had lots of time to, like, let the songs mature. And then we got in with G.G. Garth in Vancouver, who is a great producer, great engineer, and he really got the best out of us on that record and the following record, I think, as well. But, yeah, I think that record was a big deal for us because it, you know, the production quality was there. And we had matured a lot as musicians and as songwriters by that point. Really proud of that record.
What was it like having Jimmy leave and bringing Steven in?
Yeah, that was a scary time. You know, Jimmy was a really charismatic leader, really charismatic guy on stage that connected really well with fans. I think that was part of why Hey Sade was successful. A big part, shouldn't just say part, it was a big part of why Hey Sade was successful was because when Jimmy stepped out on the stage, like, there was gravitas, you know, like there was a weightiness to his presence, but he was real, you know, and he connected well with the fans during the show, and then after the show, he would hang out just like anybody else and spend time with our fans, take pictures, do autographs, sit and chat. You know, he was just really relatable. People loved him. And it's actually quite funny. Jimmy and I did not get along. We kind of hated each other. You know, it's really tough when you're in a band and you're in the van in close quarters, you know, 300 days a year, for a few years. You know, you kind of learn how to push each other's buttons. And he and I just, we fought all the time. We'd get in arguments. We almost got in a fist fight in a junkyard in Las Vegas on tour. You know, like just lots of terrible times. It was mostly he and I just butting heads over pride issues and wanting to be important and be, you know, the leader of the band and that kind of thing. It was unfortunate. Thankfully, we get along really well now. He lives like a block from me and we hang out all the time. But at the time, he and I always fought. When he announced to us that he was going to leave the band, it was really scary for the band, you know. There was a sense of relief, and I don't think Jimmy would mind me saying, there was a sense of relief, at least for me, going like, okay, I don't have to keep fighting with this guy, you know. But there was a real fear that, like, is the band going to, like, do well after this? Are we going to find somebody who can fill his shoes, and are people going to like him, you know, and still like us, you know, because he was such a big piece of who Hey Sade was. It was what people thought of. He had a very distinctive scream. He had a very distinctive presence, and it was really scary. Running out of reason.
Did Steven gel well?
Yeah, he did. It took a little bit, you know, for us to figure out, like, is this guy going to fit? He was younger than all of us. He was almost 10 years younger than me. So, like, it was kind of difficult, you know. We found him because his band, New Day Awakening, had opened for Haste Today a couple of times when we had gone through Denver. They were always cool guys. We thought they were actually pretty decent, you know. Like, a lot of times when you play with local openers, they just, they're just kind of pretentious and not very good, not very professional. They take forever to get on stage. They take forever to get off stage. You know, there's just lots of things that annoy, you know, national touring acts, partly because we're full of ourselves as well. You know, so we have less patience for other people. So Steven, his band kind of stood out. He's like, well, the dude can actually sing and the dude can actually scream and he's not like an idiot. So like, why don't we talk with him and see, you know, if he'd be interested in being a part of Haste Today, you know? So, he came out and we did a few practices. Like, this was right before, Europe. We were like getting ready to go to Europe with Juliana Theory, which was like dream come true. I'm just a huge Juliana Theory fan. And we were getting ready to go to Europe, which was kind of a perfect time to try out a new guy. We just weren't as well known in Europe. And so we felt like, okay, we can go over there. It'll be kind of safe. You know, if it totally sucks, we can still come home and figure something out, you know? We went to Europe. We had like two practices, I think, now that I think about it. We really didn't have much time. We had two practices and then we were flying to Europe, you know, with this new kid. He was like 19 years old, you know, 18. He was super young. So this is January of 2005, six. Oh, crap. Five. I don't know. It was a really interesting time. I think it was hard for him because he's probably feeling somewhat self-conscious. He's like, crap, everybody loves Jimmy and here I am. Who am I? You know, and he had to try and figure out where he fit within a assorted personalities in Haste Today. And then he probably felt like an outsider for a while, but we tried our best to make him feel like he was a part of it, you know. But we were trying to figure him out, too. Like, is this going to work? It wasn't until partway through our tour with Bleeding Through. It was Bleeding Through, Between the Buried and Me. Who was the other band? It was one other band and then us opening. And there we go. On that tour... You know, it was on that tour where we kind of decided, you know what, this is the dude, he can sing, he can scream, he's getting better at, you know, with his stage presence and knowing what to say between songs. Now, like, let's go for it. You know, we made him an official member and cut him to our LLC and all that fun stuff. But, it was a really scary time and... Then we had to get ready to write a new record not too long after that.
Whose idea was it to have Stitches be the video and single from Pressure the Hinges?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there's always a little bit of pressure for bands to write something that is going to have a wider appeal. That's always going to be there, especially with a band like Haste Today that can actually sing. You know, no offense to other metal bands that try to sing. It's just most of them suck. It sounds good in the studio, but then when you get them on the road, it's pretty horrific. I can say that because I'm not the singer, so but it still comes across as prideful, but too bad. It's my brother, and he has an amazing voice, and Michael and him can sing together like nobody's business. But anyway, because of that kind of raw talent that they had to sing and to harmonize and to pull it off live, there was always, you know, some well, I don't know if I want to say pressure, but certainly like a lot of guidance coming down from the label saying like, why don't you guys try and write a single, you know, something catchy, something that's not quite as heavy, you know, like be Haste Today, but write something that maybe you could shoot a video for, that maybe we could put some money behind, you know, that kind of thing. And certainly like as musicians that love rock and roll and love pop music, you know, there's a certain appeal to that idea, you know, like, okay, like we love rock and roll. We can write a rock song. We won't feel like we're selling out, you know, that's fine. And there's also an appeal to like, well, what if something took off and they actually put some money into it and we hit the radio and had a hit, you know, kind of, optimistic, unrealistic, dream, but you know, we thought, why not? So yeah, we wrote that song, and presented that to the label. They loved it. And they started putting like plans in place to have that be kind of a lead single for the record and to put some money into a, video for that song. And it did okay. You know, like it, unlike what Radio U, you know, that, that Christian station out of Ohio, and TVU, I don't know if that's what it's called, but their TV station, like it got a lot of play on there from what I understand. But yeah, I really like the song. Seemed to get mostly positive, but it's hard for me to tell being in the band. I don't know what the kids were actually saying. I just assumed they liked it probably.
I always thought it was a good song, but it was like a really interesting choice with Jimmy leaving the band, this new singer in, Steven's yeah. in. This is the first that I had seen of Steven, and just being like, oh, well, that's interesting. Right. And I didn't even buy Pressure the Hinges until after Dreamer came out, and being a fan of Dreamer, being like, all right, I wonder if Pressure the Hinges is actually any good. And it is, and I think it's a great record, but it was like, Stitches was enough for me to be like, that's a good song, but I'm not going to invest my money in this band.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. And I've never really thought about it from that perspective, and that for many people, that would be their first exposure to a post Jimmy Haste Today. I don't think anybody really thought that through in the band. That's really interesting. I can see why that might be a little off-putting, for some people, to be like, okay, you know, no more Jimmy. I wonder what their new record is going to be like. Oh my gosh, what's this like poppy rock song with like one line of screaming in it? You know,
right. Yeah, it was like the same thing when Spencer joined Underoath, because I was a fan of Underoath when they were on Take Hold, and just being like, what is this emo-y singing stuff? Like, that's not Underoath.
Right. Yeah, I understand. It's funny. I hadn't thought of it that way before, but now I totally get that. Luckily, the rest of that record is very heavy, and that's definitely the lightest moment of the CD. That and our cover A Long Way Down, which was super fun for us to do. Wait, no, that was on When Everything Falls. Oh, man. I don't know what's going on. Whose band is this? Crap.
So Dreamer turns 20 or turns 10 this year. That's crazy. 2008 really doesn't seem like that long ago. You left Haste Today after Dreamer. what led you to leave the band?
Yeah, it's a great, great question. You know, as a founding member of the band, like, Haste Today was, like, crazy important to me. You know, felt like it was, like, my baby, you know. You know, we had put in a lot of hours and tears and sleeping on lots of floors and yelling at lots of promoters who were trying to stiff us and, you know, like, just tons and tons of history and lots of hard work, you know, from 2001 on, you know. And I started dating my now wife, the end of 2004. And, you know, I basically told her when we started dating, I was like, listen, don't ever try and get me to quit the band. You know, the band is something that I do. And, you know, I'm not going to quit the band, you know, so it's going to be hard to date me and you don't have to, you don't have to be my boyfriend. I want you to, you know, yeah, you don't have to be my girlfriend, you know, but
yeah.
I want you to be, but like, you have a choice, you know, you can choose to like be with me and try and make this work, you know, but I don't have a choice, you know, this is my life. So anybody that I date, you know, it's going to be hard for me. You know, but anyway, I was like, so I basically kind of told her, don't try and get me to quit the band. You know, it's just, I'm not going to, you know. She's like, okay. You know, like probably like, what a jerk, you know, probably thinking. And looking back, I'm like, yeah, I was kind of a jerk. But being on tour is just really hard on every other aspect of your life. It basically ruins everything else, kind of destroys everything. You're never around for anything. You know, we'd be gone for 6 weeks and then home for 2 days and then gone for a month and then home for a week and then gone for 6 weeks and home, you know, just over and over and over and over until Christmas. And then you might get a week long break, you know, and then you're back out there, you know. And that just kind of destroys everything. Friendships, girlfriends, marriages, whatever. It just kind of ruins everything. There's no continuity. Mm-hmm. People's lives go on without you, as they should, you know, like, you're not that special, you know, like everybody's going to still get together and hang out whether you're there or not. And they're going to have shared memories that you don't have. And you're going to feel awkward when you show up and you're hanging out again. You know, that's how I felt. At least I'd come home from tour. I didn't have any real friends. Everybody's lives had moved on. And it was just kind of a hard time. It was kind of depressing. But anyway, I started seeing that kind of thing happening in my relationship with by that time, my wife, you know, I'm like married. And I'm feeling like, man, like I hardly know my wife. I'd come home from tour and I would feel like a little bit awkward, like getting back into the mix, you know? And by the time I'd feel like, okay, I'm back, everything's good, I'd be like leaving again. And it was really kind of soul crushing. And so I just realized, you know, I got married and priorities changed. And I lasted a year, you know, in the band while I was married, but I realized like, you know, Haste Today used to be my life. It was like the most important thing to me outside of my faith. And, you know, but once I got married, I was like, my wife is my life. This is the most important thing to me outside of my faith. And Haste Today was not gelling with like me prioritizing my wife and our relationship. And so I knew I had to leave. So yeah, I tried to figure out what the heck I was going to do next. But I knew that it was time for me to get out when we were on tour and our manager, Mark, called, you know, and this happened a lot. You know, you'd get a call from your manager and he'd say, hey, you know, from Mark, and he'd say, hey, just got off the phone with Galea, our agent in New York, David Galea. Hey, I just got off the phone with Galea. There's a tour offer, you know, and we would get these periodically and we would all like, I would usually take the call. I'd get all the information. I'd say, okay, I'll talk to everybody. You know, I'd find out the money, what the billing was, you know, where were we? Were we opening? Were we direct support? Where were we? You know, and how long, whatever. What was it? How many dates? Whatever. And then I'd take it to the band and we'd have a meeting and we'd vote, you know, on whether or not we were going to do a tour, whether or not it like made sense for where we were at in our album cycle and, you know, all that stuff, you know, like, was it a kind of the kind of tour we wanted to do? You know, we would turn down tours for lots of reasons, whether it was not enough money or just wasn't like the vibe that we wanted to go for or bands that we thought like made sense, you know? just wasn't part of our story, whatever. But anyway, I knew that it was probably time for me to leave when Mark called, said, hey, co-headline tour with Scary Kids Scaring Kids in Australia, 3 weeks, X amount of dollars, flying to every date, you know, backline rented, everything good, you know, such and such a dates, let me know. And I got off the phone and I was pissed, you know, and like, I've got to swallow this down and cram it down way deep because this is not a bad, this is not a bad tour. This is just me like being pissed because I don't want to be gone. And so I presented it to the guys. I said, hey, our best friends in the world, Scary Kids, and like, we want to go out. We're going to go out together in Australia for 3 weeks. This is the money, blah, blah, blah. It all makes sense, right? Like, let's vote, you know? Of course, everybody votes for it. I voted against it just because I'm like, well, I'm just going to be real, you know? But I knew then that if I couldn't get excited about good money in Australia with our best friends, you know, I knew that, like, my heart wasn't in Pace Today anymore, and I wasn't going to be good for the band anymore because I was going to hold them back, you know? Mm-hmm. So that was kind of the wake-up call for me, and I quit a couple months later after a little time to, like, really pray about it and figure out what I wanted to do.
Were on one song on Coward, right? You were on Accept.
Yes, yeah.
What was it like getting back in the saddle?
Yeah, that was really fun. You know, Jason and I basically got together and we got in my basement and just wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote. I think we wrote 4 or 5 songs, maybe more, and had like tons of pieces of other material, you know, like we had enough to probably piece together a few Frankenstein songs, you know, after 4 or 5 were done. But yeah, we just wrote as many as we could, demoed it in my basement, really raw, really sucky. But, everybody has a good imagination and they could hear, you know, like what was good, what was bad, whatever. But, yeah, it was really fun. You know, toward the end of Haste the Day's time, a lot of the music was written by Jason and then myself, like working out the details with him. So he would come with a ton of riffs. He and I would work through those riffs, kind of put them together, write transitions, make sure that we were like telling a story through the song. And so it felt like old times in that way. He and I always really worked well together. And so, yeah, we just wanted to write something that was heavy. You know, we wanted it to sound like mid-2000s Haste the Day. We wanted it to be heavy. We wanted it to have a good hook, you know, that people could, like, sing along to and have fun. And wanted there to be a breakdown, you know, cliche metalcore, you know. We just wanted it to sound like Haste the Day. I think we were able to accomplish that. It was really fun for us to do that. And we basically took the song mostly done, you know, to the rest of the guys, emailed it to everybody and said, hey, what do you think? Is this it? Is this the song? And everybody was like, yeah, this is the song. This is it. We love it. And so everybody kind of recorded their parts. And it was funny, you know, like at the time I had 2 kids at the time and I was just super busy with work. And so I recorded the drums first in Indianapolis, with a guy out here that's done a lot of like heavy stuff. And then Jason actually went down to Nashville and recorded the guitars with Steven after I had done the drums, like, you know, like a skeleton. I didn't have any guitar stuff. I just went by myself, set up my drums, you know, played the song. Like I set up the click track and said, hey, it's at 100 and such beats per minute. Let's just go, you know? And then I think Brennan and Michael and Steven all did vocals down Nashville. I don't really know. Like I played my drum part and then I didn't hear it again until it was mixed, I think. Like until it was like ready to come out, you know. It's just one of those things where when you're not really in the band, and I wasn't in the band, like I just wasn't part of the free flow of information that was happening within the band, you know. So like I didn't really hear it until it was almost ready for it to come out, but I was really happy with how it came out. I thought it came out sounding like Ace Today and heavy and fun.
Yeah, that whole record's great, top to bottom. I loved it. It was.
Yeah, I think it's a great record. I think I think it showed like maturity of musicianship from Ace Today. You know, like it doesn't sound like old Ace Today, but it probably shouldn't. Like everybody's grown up. Everybody has like new and different influences. You know, and they still wanted to make a heavy record, but it's not heavy like Pressure of the Hinges was heavy, or you know, it was a different kind of heavy, and I thought it was really artful and mature songwriting, and I was glad to be a part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. And that record, like, it feels really dark and like broody. I always loved it. So
it's kind of a scary record. Like when you get to the end of that song, I think it's Gnaw. You know, when you get to the end of that song and it keeps getting heavier and slower, and there's just this growing sense of like doom in your stomach as you listen to that going over and over and simplifying and deconstructing. Like just really smart the way they did that. I think it's a great song.
Devin, thanks so much for reaching out to the show to say you enjoyed the old episodes and for coming on talking with me. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Love it.
Thanks for listening to As the Story Grows. Our theme song was written and composed by the legendary Bob Nana. If you like what you hear, subscribe on iTunes and give the show a rating and review. If you'd like to support the show financially, click on the Patreon link at asthestorygrows.com. If you enjoyed this episode, share it on social media with your friends. Much appreciated, and thanks for listening. Start